This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents How to Talk to Anyone at Work, 72 Little Tricks for Big Success in Business Relationships by Leah Lowndes, performed by Joyce Bean and the author.
To my many thousands of amazing seminar students, clients, and readers who shared challenges they faced with their bosses, colleagues, reports, and customers. I learned as much from you as you did from me, and together we found solutions. Introduction: How to Talk to Anyone at Work, Little Tricks for Big Success, Communicating on the Job. Some people have it all. Everyone at work admires them. They easily turn colleagues into friends, bosses into backers, and prospects into buyers. They get special treatment, raises, and promotions. People respect them and they get to the top fast. What's their secret? You'll soon find out. Perhaps, so far, you haven't been that fortunate at work. Most people aren't. You may be stuck with a boss who constantly criticizes you, is a control freak, micromanager, or just plain jerk. I'm sure there are a couple of coworkers who drive you berserk due to their gossiping, bullying, or backstabbing. If you're the boss, you may have a few reports who make you want to tear your hair out, or theirs. And who hasn't had customers they'd like to strangle because they're nitpickers, know-it-alls, or are never satisfied? When you were a kid, nothing prepared you for these workplace characters because, hopefully, you had parents and relatives who believed in you and complimented you when you did something good. You had teachers who encouraged you, listened to you, and didn't secretly hope you'd fail. You had friends you trusted and enjoyed being around. Of course, you ran into the usual assortment of bullies and creeps, but you didn't have to deal with them 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And you didn't need to watch every word coming out of your mouth for fear of consequences. So, when you graduated, you assumed your job wouldn't be all that different. Maybe you even looked forward to your adventures in the working world and expected it to be a supportive and somewhat pleasant environment. But then, pow! What happened at work probably astonished you. Nothing prepared you for the challenges you'd confront, nor the crazies you'd have to deal with. I'm sure they gave you a job description, but I bet no one gave you the bottom line on difficult people, cliques, and complicated corporate culture. You wanted to ask someone who'd been there longer to give you the scoop, but you feared too many questions might make you look stupid. No doubt you saw some of your new colleagues acting unprofessionally and others doing things behind the boss's back. Maybe even your boss was goofing off or accused you of doing something you didn't do. But you didn't dare speak up for fear of being fired. The dynamic of the workplace is different from that of real life. You're not just dealing with an individual at work. You must factor in his or her position, prejudices, boss, and relationship with everyone else in the company. You must also do it in a second language through email, texts, chat applications, and video conferencing. Some of you must work with augmented reality or whatever new technology your particular job involves. Okay, I've painted a grim picture of the workplace, and I hope you don't feel like you're looking down a gun barrel at your job. But during my several decades of consulting and teaching public and in-house corporate seminars to thousands of employees and supervisors, I've heard a myriad of disaster stories. Truth is stranger than fiction, especially at work. No matter what you do or where you earn your living, your work can be either a dream job or a nightmare. It's all up to you. Up to me, you ask? Why? My bosses and coworkers are the ones who are the problem. Yes, they probably are. But with one incredible and learnable skill, you can change the way people treat you increase your happiness, and boost your chances of getting ahead. It won't happen overnight, but I will share a plan that you can start using the minute you walk into work tomorrow morning. If you follow the 72 techniques, which I like to call little tricks, it will make bosses respect you, colleagues more congenial, and your reports more dedicated. The bottom line, life on the job will be more pleasant, productive, and successful. What's the number one skill you need? You guessed it. Whether it's online or in person, it's the rare ability to communicate effectively with everyone in your place of employment. I'm not just talking about regular communication skills, the kind people need to get along in everyday life. I'm talking about specific techniques necessary for success on the job. It doesn't matter whether you're employed by or run a big corporation, a medium-sized company, or a small business, a factory, retail, or family business. The techniques work in every type of organization. I'm sure you've heard bosses solemnly decree, as though they're the first person to ever say it, "It's a problem with communication." Well, duh, they're right. But everyone thinks the communication problem is with other people, not them. If only they didn't do that, or if only they didn't think that way, if only they weren't so stubborn, so stupid, so mean, so irritating, so whatever. When the communication problem starts to affect the bottom line, that's when management gets involved. The top dogs start barking and sending memos about the importance of better communication. Or they establish a policy of more meetings, or fewer meetings, or no meetings. Oops, they discover none of those worked. Then they say, what about bringing in a consultant or sending employees to seminars? Too expensive? What about online seminars and training? Sure, seminars where employees can sit solo in front of a computer and learn how to deal face-to-face with other human beings. That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Sadly, no. They miss this crucial point. To communicate deeply and effectively with colleagues and bosses, you must make them feel you understand and respect each of them individually. Encouraging the people you work with to open up and paving the path for them to listen to you is crucial. If you accomplish this with everyone, you will be an excellent communicator at work, even while making challenging presentations. Be assured this is not just another book about dealing with difficult people. Of course, you'll meet some of those disagreeable types here, but too much has already been written on how to silence and squash those walking, talking headaches. This book is unique because you will learn exceptional skills that get right to the gut of the problem. If you start using these tips early in your relationships with everyone at work, you'll prevent problems from developing in the first place. If your issues with certain individuals have already started, I'll show you how to turn those unpleasant relationships around. That way, you won't be part of the legions of people who hate their jobs. That's 70%, according to a recent Forbes survey. It won't happen overnight, but if you stick with it, the results are guaranteed. I hate my job. Sadly, over the years, I've heard it all. I hate my job. I hate my boss. I hate my coworkers. I hate my schedule. I hate my customers. The commute. The computer, the office copier. I often start my seminars for employees whose bosses had forced them to attend by asking, how many of you are happy to be here today? A few tentatively raise their hands just to be polite. But then I ask, how many of you are happy to be out of the office today? This time, hands all over the room instantly shoot up. We all laugh, including me. But inside, I feel extremely sad. That's not the way a job should be. Your work should make you feel fulfilled and valued. You deserve to be rewarded in more ways than with money. You deserve to be appreciated for the work you do and the many hours you give the company. Your job should bring you a sense of satisfaction and many joyful moments during the day. So what kept so many of my seminar attendees from feeling that way? The answer was universal. Practically all of them told me it was problems with individuals they had to work with, whether they're bosses, direct reports, colleagues, or customers. What do all these answers have in common? Right, they're all people. People you just happen to work with. Many of you read my book, How to Talk to Anyone, 92 Little Tricks for Big Success in Relationships. There I gave you tips primarily for social situations and making friends. But countless readers tell me how many of the techniques also help them on the job. Much to my delight, How to Talk to Anyone became a bestseller and is still topping the charts in 26 languages around the world. How rewarding it is to know that the basic people skills I shared apply to diverse cultures. Countless readers wrote to me telling me how the techniques changed their lives. If you are one of those who contacted me, please know that receiving your messages is one of the greatest joys of my life. Hearing your experiences and those of thousands of my seminar participants inspired me to write this book. Imagine how thrilled I was when I got a call from my publisher, McGraw-Hill, asking if I'd write a sequel dealing with business situations. You've heard of those near-death phenomena when someone's entire life flashes through his or her mind? Well, right there on the phone, it seemed like my past 20-plus years of consulting and giving seminars on corporate communication skills instantaneously raced through my head. In a heartbeat, I realized I had to write How to Talk to Anyone at Work. First, I reflected on my own experiences and struggles entering the working world, and on the thousands of professional challenges my clients and seminar students reported. I reread hundreds of your emails detailing your problems on the job. While writing this book, I also consulted with professionals from a wide variety of fields who provided their horror stories and the communication techniques they'd tried. You'll soon meet some of these folks and hear about their successes, disasters, and what they did to eventually get good results. Naturally, I've disguised their names and organizations, but the people, the problems, and the industries they work in are very real. This book won't help you change the more challenging individuals at work into better people. It doesn't mean horrible bosses will suddenly realize the error of their ways and treat everyone with respect. Natural-born betrayers won't give up their backstabbing ways, and flaunting flatterers won't stop conspicuously playing up to you. Liars won't suddenly discover the virtue of truth, and protesters won't turn into Pollyannas. Know-it-alls won't decide to be humble, braggarts won't convert to modesty, and mean colleagues will stay mean. But even if you can't change the qualities of those characters, here is my promise. When you employ these little tricks, your unsavory co-workers will save their nasty behaviors for others. In fact, they won't even think of using their sinister ways on you because, beginning with the first tip, you'll start earning their esteem and warmth. No matter how long you've been working with them, you'll discover ways to turn your work relationships around in a fraction of the time it took for any existing negativity to develop. Would you be happier if you never had to work again? Most people, without a second thought, would shout yes. But minor details like making a living, supporting a family, having a roof over your head, and enjoying a few luxuries decree that most of us don't have the choice. A 6th century BC philosopher had the answer to the dilemma of work. Confucius declared, "Choose a job you love, and you will never have to work a day in your life." I'd have to ponder the abstract and metaphysical aspects of the word work before I could say, "Spot on, Confucius." But I do know that if you can turn the job you have into one you love, you've taken a big step in the right direction. That truly is possible, because in most cases, it's the people we work with that make our jobs gratifying or grueling. Another reason writing this book was thrilling is that so much has happened in the years since I wrote How to Talk to Anyone. We now communicate in ways that never existed to the extent they do now. Even today, in some sectors, picking up the phone or dropping by someone's desk to talk things out seems primitive. Digital dominates. The modes of communicating, email, texting, social media, chats, video conferencing, augmented reality to show your ideas, and more, continue to evolve. A very personal reason I said yes to this book. Don't laugh, but I have always been fascinated by offices. I know that sounds bizarre, but I'm dead serious. This unusual attraction started when I was about 6 years old. My dad was in advertising, and because both my parents worked, he sometimes took me to his job on snow days when school was canceled. I'll never forget how cool the copywriters and executives looked in their dark suits, crisp white shirts, and skinny neckties. I was dazzled by the secretaries walking by in slim skirts and taking shorthand for their male bosses. Does that sound like a late 1960s scene out of the hit TV show Mad Men? Yes, that's exactly what it was like. And in my unenlightened immaturity, I loved it. Never mind that it was shamefully sexist and chauvinistic. I wasn't old enough to understand that. Gratefully, the Don Draper era is history, and thanks to Mad Men, we can now roll our eyes and shake our heads. When the kids in my neighborhood went out to play, my girlfriends would squeal, "Let's play house!" Then they'd look around and ask, "Who wants to be the mommy?" And, "Who wants to be the daddy?" Because I was something of a tomboy, they'd usually ask me to play the latter. But I didn't want to be the daddy, or the mommy, or the baby. I hated playing house. I wanted to play office. My favorite toy in the whole world was a red plastic rotary dial telephone with an ear-shattering bring ringtone. It was music to my ears. I loved sitting at my desk, an old cabinet door placed across the seats of two chairs. When I could talk the other kids into playing office, I'd quickly ask, before they changed their minds, who's going to play the boss and who's going to play the secretary? I didn't care which role I had. I just loved being in my office. But then my childhood fantasy workplace didn't have domineering bosses, exasperating colleagues, or disappointing direct reports. In my imaginary job, there were no office politics, no promotions or demotions, no unspoken rules, no fear of getting fired, no strict chain of command, and no negativity or dysfunctional corporate culture. And there was no miscommunication. It was just a game, and nothing was at stake. But your job is not a game. It's real life, and a lot is at stake. What about you? What do you want from your job? Is professional success and shimmying up the totem pole your goal? Do you long for that view from the top? Do you relish being conductor of the symphony, the maestro directing your employees to produce a beautiful product or service? If so, I hope you realize the top of the peak is not the enviable position it's often cracked up to be. The air is thinner at those heights, and it's harder to breathe. You're treading on a tightrope with few safety nets. One misstep can cause you to crash to the ground. And the larger the company, the longer your descent, meaning the harder you'll hit. One professional bad choice or personal indiscretion has tripped up many a top leader, and a tumble from those heights can mangle you beyond repair. Suppose reaching the peak is not your goal. All you ask is happiness at work, fulfillment from your career, and the satisfaction of a job well done. Actually, you're the lucky ones. But even to get that, you have to play your cards right. You must learn how to recover from slips, avoid the traps, and get on with the business of being valuable to your company, your family, your friends, and most of all, yourself. Happily, the way to achieve this goal is to make smooth moves in five crucial categories, which I call the five C's. Number one, confidence. If you don't have confidence in yourself, how can you expect others to? In this section, you will find ways to gently show that you are 100% self-assured from the moment you meet them and throughout your working relationship. Number two, caring. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care should be gospel in the workplace. Sadly, it seldom is. Here you'll find ways to convince everyone at work that you sincerely care about them and the company. Number three, clarity. At work, you can't leave clear communication to chance. The stakes are too high. When explaining something to a colleague, have you been tempted to scream, "I know you believe you understand what you think I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant"? Very few have found the solution to this persistent dilemma. I'll help you with that, whether you're the speaker or the listener. Number four, credibility. Speaking without credibility is like talking to the wind. Your words are worthless, and no one will listen if they don't believe you and in you. In this section, you will find techniques to win the trust and respect of everyone you work with. Number five, coexistence with cruel bosses and crazy colleagues. Wouldn't work be great if it weren't for the people? Well, for the foreseeable future, flesh and blood human beings are here to stay. We'll tackle some of the most troublesome types and talk about how to deal with them so no one comes out emotionally or professionally destroyed. And today, it's even tougher because you must demonstrate these five crucial success characteristics in a web-based world. Let's get started.
Introduction. How to talk to anyone at work. Little tricks for big success communicating on the job. Some people have it all. Everyone at work admires them. They easily turn colleagues into friends, bosses into backers, and prospects into buyers. They get special treatment, raises, and promotions. People respect them, and they get to the top fast. What's their secret? You'll soon find out. Perhaps so far you haven't been that fortunate at work. Most people aren't. You may be stuck with a boss who constantly criticizes you, is a control freak, micromanager, or just plain jerk. I'm sure there are a couple of coworkers who drive you berserk due to their gossiping, bullying, or backstabbing. If you're the boss, you may have a few reports who make you want to tear your hair out, or theirs. And who hasn't had customers they'd like to strangle because they're nitpickers, know-it-alls, or are never satisfied? When you were a kid, nothing prepared you for these workplace characters, because hopefully you had parents and relatives who believed in you and complimented you when you did something good. You had teachers who encouraged you, listened to you, and didn't secretly hope you'd fail. You had friends you trusted and enjoyed being around. Of course, you ran into the usual assortment of bullies and creeps, but you didn't have to deal with them 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. And you didn't need to watch every word coming out of your mouth for fear of consequences. So when you graduated, you assumed your job wouldn't be all that different. Maybe you even looked forward to your adventures in the working world and expected it to be a supportive and somewhat pleasant environment. But then, pow! What happened at work probably astonished you. Nothing prepared you for the challenges you'd confront nor the crazies you'd have to deal with. I'm sure they gave you a job description, but I bet no one gave you the bottom line on the difficult people, cliques, and complicated corporate culture. You wanted to ask someone who'd been there longer to give you the scoop, but you feared too many questions might make you look stupid. No doubt you saw some of your new colleagues acting unprofessionally and others doing things behind the boss's back. Maybe even your boss was goofing off or accused you of something you didn't do. But you didn't dare speak up for fear of being fired. The dynamic of the workplace is different from that of real life. You're not just dealing with an individual at work. You must factor in his or her position, prejudices, boss, and relationship with everyone else in the company. You must also do it in a second language, through email, texts, chat applications, and video conferencing. Some of you must work with augmented reality or whatever new technology your particular job involves. Okay, I've painted a grim picture of the workplace, and I hope you don't feel like you're looking down a gun barrel at your job. But during my several decades of consulting and teaching public and in-house corporate seminars to thousands of employees and supervisors, I've heard a myriad of disaster stories. Truth is stranger than fiction, especially at work. No matter what you do or where you earn your living, your work can be either a dream job or a nightmare. It's all up to you. Up to me, you ask? Why? My bosses and co-workers are the ones who are the problem. Yes, they probably are. But with one incredible and learnable skill, you can change the way people treat you, increase your happiness, and boost your chances of getting ahead. It won't happen overnight, but I'll share a plan that you can start using the minute you walk into work tomorrow morning. If you follow the 72 techniques, which I like to call little tricks, it will make bosses respect you, colleagues more congenial, and your reports more dedicated. The bottom line? Life on the job will be more pleasant, productive, and successful. What's the number one skill you need? You guessed it. Whether it's online or in person, it's the rare ability to communicate effectively with everyone in your place of employment. I'm not just talking about regular communication skills, the kind people need to get along in everyday life. I'm talking about specific techniques necessary for success on the job. It doesn't matter whether you're employed by or run a big corporation, a medium-sized company, or a small business, a factory, retail, or family business. The techniques work in every type of organization. I'm sure you've heard bosses solemnly decree, as though they're the first person to ever say it, "It's a problem with communication." Well, duh, they're right. But everyone thinks the communication problem is with other people, not them. If only they didn't do that. If only they didn't think that way. If only they weren't so stubborn, so stupid, so mean, so irritating, so whatever. When the communication problem starts to affect the bottom line, that's when management gets involved. The top dogs start barking and sending memos about the importance of better communication, or they establish a policy of more meetings, or fewer meetings, or no meetings. Oops, they discover none of those worked. Then they say, "What about bringing in a consultant or sending employees to seminars? Too expensive? What about online seminars and training?" Sure, seminars where employees can sit solo in front of a computer and learn how to deal face-to-face with other human beings? That makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Sadly, no. They miss this crucial point. To communicate deeply and effectively with colleagues and bosses, you must make them feel you understand and respect each of them individually. Encouraging the people you work with to open up and paving the path for them to listen to you is crucial. If you accomplish this with everyone, you will be an excellent communicator at work, even while making challenging presentations. Be assured this is not just another book about dealing with difficult people. Of course, you'll meet some of those disagreeable types here. But too much has already been written on how to silence and squash those walking, talking headaches. This book is unique because you'll learn exceptional skills that get right to the gut of the problem. If you start using these tips early in your relationships with everyone at work, you'll prevent problems from developing in the first place. If your issues with certain individuals have already started, I'll show you how to turn those unpleasant relationships around. That way you won't be part of the legions of people who hate their jobs. That's 70% according to a recent Forbes survey. It won't happen overnight, but if you stick with it, the results are guaranteed. I hate my job. Sadly, over the years, I've heard it all. I hate my job. I hate my boss. I hate my coworkers. I hate my schedule. I hate my customers, the commute, the computer, the office copier. I often start my seminars for employees whose bosses had forced them to attend by asking, "How many of you are happy to be here today?" A few tentatively raise their hands just to be polite. But then I ask, "How many of you are happy to be out of the office today?" This time, hands all over the room instantly shoot up. We all laugh, including me. But inside, I feel extremely sad. That's not the way a job should be. Your work should make you feel fulfilled and valued. You deserve to be rewarded in more ways than with money. You deserve to be appreciated for the work you do and the many hours you give the company. Your job should bring you a sense of satisfaction and many joyful moments during the day. So, what kept so many of my seminar attendees from feeling that way? The answer was universal. Practically all of them told me it was problems with individuals they had to work with, whether their bosses, direct reports, colleagues, or customers. What do all these answers have in common? Right, they're all people. People you just happen to work with. Many of you read my book, How to Talk to Anyone, 92 Little Tricks for Big Success in Relationships. There, I gave you tips primarily for social situations and making friends, but countless readers tell me how many of the techniques also help them on the job. Much to my delight, How to Talk to Anyone became a bestseller and is still topping the charts in 26 languages around the world. How rewarding it is to know that the basic people skills I shared apply to diverse cultures. Countless readers wrote to tell me how the techniques changed their lives. If you are one of those who contacted me, please know that receiving your message is one of the greatest joys in my life. Hearing your experiences and those of thousands of my seminar participants inspired me to write this book. Imagine how thrilled I was when I got a call from my publisher, McGraw-Hill, asking if I'd write a sequel dealing with business situations. You've heard of those near-death phenomena when someone's entire life flashes through his or her mind? Well, right there on the phone, it seemed like my past 20-plus years of consulting and giving seminars on corporate communication skills instantly raced through my head. In a heartbeat, I realized I had to write How to Talk to Anyone at Work. First, I reflected on my own experiences and struggles entering the working world and on the thousands of professional challenges my clients and seminar students reported. I reread hundreds of your emails detailing your problems on the job. While writing this book, I also consulted with professionals from a wide variety of fields who provided their horror stories and the communication techniques they'd tried. You'll soon meet some of these folks and hear about their successes, disasters, and what they did to eventually get good results. Naturally, I've disguised their names and organizations, but the people, the problems, and the industries they work in are very real. This book won't help you change the more challenging individuals at work into better people. It doesn't mean horrible bosses will suddenly realize the error of their ways and treat everyone with respect. Natural-born betrayers won't give up their backstabbing ways, and flaunting flatterers won't stop conspicuously playing up to you. Liars won't suddenly discover the virtue of truth, and protesters won't turn into Pollyannas. Know-it-alls won't decide to be humble, braggarts won't convert to modesty, and mean colleagues will stay mean. But even if you can't change the qualities of those characters, here is my promise. When you employ these little tricks, your unsavory coworkers will save their nasty behaviors for others. In fact, they won't even think of using their sinister ways on you because, beginning with the first tip, you'll start earning their esteem and warmth no matter how long you've been working with them. You'll discover ways to turn your work relationships around in a fraction of the time it took for any existing negativity to develop. Would you be happier if you never had to work again? Most people, without a second thought, would shout yes. But minor details like making a living, supporting a family, having a roof over your head, and enjoying a few luxuries decree that most of us don't have the choice. A 6th century BC philosopher had the answer to the dilemma of work. Confucius declared, "Choose a job you love, and you will never have to work a day in your life." I'd have to ponder the abstract and metaphysical aspects of the word work before I could say, "Spot on, Confucius." But I do know that if you can turn the job you have into one you love, you've taken a big step in the right direction. That truly is possible, because in most cases, it's the people we work with that make our jobs gratifying or grueling. Another reason writing this book was thrilling is that so much has happened in the years since I wrote How to Talk to Anyone. We now communicate in ways that never existed to the extent they do now. Even today in some sectors, picking up the phone or dropping by someone's desk to talk things out seems primitive. Digital dominates. The modes of communicating, email, texting, social media, chats, video conferencing, augmented reality to show your ideas, and more, continue to evolve. A very personal reason I said yes to this book. Don't laugh, but I have always been fascinated by offices. I know that sounds bizarre, but I'm dead serious. This unusual attraction started when I was about 6 years old. My dad was in advertising, and because both my parents worked, he sometimes took me to his job on snow days when school was canceled. I'll never forget how cool the copywriters and executives looked in their dark suits, crisp white shirts, and skinny neckties. I was dazzled by the secretaries walking by in slim skirts and taking shorthand for their male bosses. Does that sound like a late 1960s scene out of the hit TV show Mad Men? Yes, that's exactly what it was like. And in my unenlightened immaturity, I loved it. Never mind that it was shamefully sexist and chauvinistic. I wasn't old enough to understand that. Gratefully, the Don Draper era is history, and thanks to Mad Men, we can now roll our eyes and shake our heads. When the kids in my neighborhood went out to play, my girlfriends would squeal, "Let's play house!" Then they'd look around and ask, "Who wants to be the mommy? And who wants to be the daddy?" Because I was something of a tomboy, they'd usually ask me to play the latter. But I didn't want to be the daddy, or the mommy, or the baby. I hated playing house. I wanted to play office. My favorite toy in the whole world was a red plastic rotary dial telephone with an ear-shattering bring ringtone. It was music to my ears. I loved sitting at my desk, an old cabinet door placed across the seats of 2 chairs. When I could talk the other kids into playing office, I'd quickly ask, before they changed their minds, "Who's going to play the boss, and who's going to play the secretary?" I didn't care which role I had. I just loved being in my office. But then my childhood fantasy workplace didn't have domineering bosses, exasperating colleagues, or disappointing direct reports. In my imaginary job, there were no office politics, no promotions or demotions, no unspoken rules, no fear of getting fired, no strict chain of command, and no negativity or dysfunctional corporate culture. And there was no miscommunication. It was just a game, and nothing was at stake. But your job is not a game. It's real life, and a lot is at stake. What about you? What do you want from your job? Is professional success and shimmying up the totem pole your goal? Do you long for that view from the top? Do you relish being conductor of the symphony, the maestro directing your employees to produce a beautiful product or service? If so, I hope you realize the top of the peak is not the enviable position it's often cracked up to be. The air is thinner at those heights, and it's harder to breathe. You're treading on a tightrope with a few safety nets. One misstep can cause you to crash to the ground. And the larger the company, the longer your descent, meaning the harder you'll hit. One professional bad choice or personal indiscretion has tripped up many a top leader, and a tumble from those heights can mangle you beyond repair. Suppose reaching the peak is not your goal. All you ask is happiness at work, fulfillment from your career, and the satisfaction of a job well done. Actually, you're the lucky ones. But even to get that, you have to play your cards right. You must learn how to recover from slips, avoid the traps, and get on with the business of being valuable to your company, your family, your friends, and most of all, yourself. Happily, the way to achieve this goal is to make smooth moves in five crucial categories, which I call the five C's. Confidence. If you don't have confidence in yourself, how can you expect others to? In this section, you'll find ways to gently show everyone that you are 100% self-assured from the moment you meet them and throughout your working relationship. Caring. People don't care how much you know until they know how much you care should be gospel in the workplace. Sadly, it seldom is. Here, you'll find ways to convince everyone at work that you sincerely care about them and the company. Clarity. At work, you can't leave clear communication to chance. The stakes are too high. When explaining something to a colleague, you have been tempted to scream. I know you believe you understand what you think I said, but I'm not sure you realize that what you heard is not what I meant. Very few have found the solution to this persistent dilemma. I'll help you with that, whether you're the speaker or the listener. Credibility. Speaking without credibility is like talking to the wind. Your words are worthless, and no one will listen if they don't believe you and in you. In this section, you'll find techniques to win the trust and respect of everyone you work with. Coexistence, with cruel bosses and crazy colleagues. Wouldn't work be great if it weren't for the people? Well, for the foreseeable future, flesh and blood human beings are here to stay. We'll tackle some of the most troublesome types and talk about how to deal with them so no one comes out emotionally or professionally destroyed. And today it's even tougher because you must demonstrate these five crucial success characteristics in a web-based world. Let's get started. Part 1. Confidence. Chapter 1. Your confidence, or lack of it, stands out like a fly in the sugar bowl. Why is exuding self-assurance so important? Well, who has known you longer than anyone else? Who has been with you every moment of every day since you were born? Who has observed everything you have ever said and done in life? That's right, you. So only you know better than anyone else that your actions merit confidence. Even if you have deep-rooted insecurities, almost everybody does, you don't want to reveal them at work. You must look like you are sure you can accomplish whatever you want. Unfortunately, when you're fearful or insecure, a myriad of changes take place in your body, and they're hard to hide. As soon as colleagues see you, they can sense anxiety like a dog sniffs fear. However, two-legged upright creatures do the detective work with their eyes, not their noses. Calculating each other's self-assurance is an inborn instinct that developed thousands of years ago. Imagine two club-carrying cavemen, Thag and Atuk, stumbling across each other in the wilderness. They freeze. They lock eyes. Now it's instant decision time. Is he friend or foe? If staring turns to fighting, who will win? They ask themselves, does Big Thag look powerful enough to hammer me? Does Little Atuk look cunning enough to outfox me? In a flash, each decides, should I fight or take flight? Fast forward to today. When two competing job candidates, Carla and Connor, wait in the foyer, they don't measure each other's muscles. They instinctively calculate each other's demeanor. Does he look confident about getting the job? Does she seem sure she'll win the desired position? Carla and Connor are playing professional poker. Who will get the ace, and who will draw a deuce? Once hired, exuding confidence, especially during the first several days on the job, is equally important, because bosses, supervisors, and co-workers keep a close eye on you. While shaking hands or saying hi, the caveman instinct takes over. They assess you in terms of qualities related to professional success at the company. Does he look like he can handle the job? Does she look like she'll be a good asset to the team? Will he be able to relate to customers? Will she be fun to work with? Will he want my job? Will she support my project? They all know. A slouch can signal insecurity. Averted eyes may indicate timidity. A lowered head could mean embarrassment. Fidgeting might imply dishonesty. Folded arms could suggest defensiveness. Shallow breathing signals self-doubt. Now here comes the sticky part. If they sense you're not sure of yourself, they go on heightened alert for any shortcomings. People are subject to a phenomenon scientists call the confirmation bias, the desire to prove to themselves that their initial observations were correct. Individuals come to an almost instantaneous conclusion about you, and their inner jury quickly decides whether that impression was right or wrong. Nobody wants to feel wrong. How many people do you think make up that jury? Not the usual 12 like American jurisprudence decrees. Just one. Not only that, but this one-person jury is also the final judge. Plus, he or she plays private investigator, actively searching for evidence to back up his or her initial pronouncement on you. Sadly, it doesn't take long for colleagues to assume they have all the answers about you. When average employees meet you, they see you as a new colleague, aka competitor, whom they fear might someday take their job, and so they don't want to find strong qualities. Finding faults in you makes them feel more secure. Regrettably, many talented people who have the smarts to rise to the top still haven't mastered the skill of projecting self-assurance. What about you? You know you have the insight, intelligence, ability, and talent to do the job better than anyone else, but maybe you lack the knack for showing how good you are. It's probably because nobody ever taught you the specific techniques for displaying confidence that we'll talk about here. It doesn't matter whether you've been on the job for 10 minutes, 10 years, or more. You can start using the next little trick the moment you walk in the door first thing tomorrow morning. Chapter 2. Your First Move. No doubt you've heard the expression, you never have a second chance to make a good first impression. Sure you have, probably so many times you'd rather eat hairballs than hear it again. The mental snapshot people take when meeting you for the first time burns itself into their memory bank and colors their opinion of you from that moment forward. And today, that first impression is more important than any time in history, because people who work together in a digital world see each other far fewer times. However, here's a little secret most people don't know. The first glimpse colleagues have of you coming in the door each morning also packs a powerful punch and has a ripple effect throughout the entire day. If your demeanor impresses colleagues and bosses at first sight that day, it becomes the image they remember and colors all subsequent interactions. Not giving any thought to their entrance, many employees stroll into the office thinking, "Ho-hum, here I am at work again, another day, another dollar." But suppose tomorrow a colleague shows up looking a little different, say with a new haircut. You'll spot it immediately. When you see her later in the day, you'll still notice the new look. The third time, however, the hairstyle is just part of her everyday image, and you're not even aware of it the next day. Now, let's talk about how you look walking into the office. Like most people, you may be ruminating about the emails in your inbox, or stewing about something your supervisor said to you the day before. Perhaps you're figuring how to handle an upcoming video conference with a difficult client. Maybe your mind isn't on work at all. You might be mulling over the squabble you had with your spouse last night, or how the kids slammed the door when they left for school this morning. Frustrations like those can disturb your thoughts to such an extent that you're completely unaware of the image you're projecting. You don't think other people can read your mind? In a way, they can. Everything shows in your expression, how you hold yourself, the way you walk, and your first words. The second they spot you, people subconsciously pick up on your vibes, and that first daily impression sticks. In a study called First Impressions, Making Up Your Mind After 100 Millisecond Exposure to a Face, subjects viewed various people and recorded their immediate judgments. Even after viewing them longer, nothing significantly altered their opinions. That first flash had said it all. Let's say you're a bit late to work because the traffic was terrible and you're frazzled. You race into the building clutching a file of papers while juggling a full cup of coffee. You fumble in your pocket or purse for your swipe card to enter. Somehow, you manage to open the door without spilling or dropping anything, and you barrel through. Wait, stop! Rewind the video a few seconds. Now take a deep breath and throw your shoulders back. Check your coffee cup and organize whatever you are carrying so no papers or other items are jutting out. Put on a pleasant, professional, almost serene expression. Flush any negativity out of your mind concerning coworkers you're about to see. Of course, it's challenging to set aside their previous slights, dismissive attitudes, and rudeness. But if you're ruminating about the time Candace cut you off in a meeting or Kurt took credit for your work, it shows. The only thing colleagues see is an employee who is stressed out or stewing about something. Turn your arrival at work into a grand entrance, like you're walking on the red carpet to accept your Oscar. It's showtime. Little trick number one, your daily grand entrance. Even if it means getting up a few minutes earlier, do all grooming before leaving home. No putting on lipstick in the rearview mirror or combing your hair as you sprint down the hall. If you're late and papers are flying out of your bag, come to a screeching halt several feet before the door. Breathe deeply and think about a song you like, your adorable pet, or that ecstatic moment on the beach. Anything but the hassles at work. Now gracefully glide in with a smile and a cheery good morning. You may find it strange that a book entitled How to Talk to Anyone at Work begins with a technique that involves no words. Why did I do it? Because far more than words, what your colleagues and bosses see has a greater impact. Many people think spoken words are the foremost way human beings communicate. This is far from the truth. The findings of Albert Mehrabian, professor emeritus of psychology at UCLA, are now universally accepted. Only 7% of your communication is composed of spoken words. The sound of your voice is another 38%. But 55% of your impact on your coworkers comes from your stature, your movements, and your expressions. Companies are investing billions in technology to capture these elements in robots and holograms. Will they succeed? It's too early to tell, but for now, it doesn't cost anything to let your body do a lot of the talking. Of course, the first words out of your mouth also count, and neuroscience has shown how special it is to hear your name on someone else's lips. Studies using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, show that it activates the pleasure center in your brain. It's one of the first words a baby recognizes, so it's understandable. Since birth, your colleagues have heard their name said thousands of times by friends and loving relatives, and you saying it tomorrow morning echoes that fondness. Make it a point to greet several of your colleagues by name. Just don't overdo it, or it sounds obsequious. Now let's talk about how to reinforce that confident and charismatic image throughout the day. Chapter 3. How to Look Dynamic All Day Long. This one makes you look like A woman who knows where she's going, or a man who knows what he wants. Let me tell you how this little trick was hatched. One of my speaking clients, a mergers and acquisitions, MA advisory firm, booked my presentation on executive image. I wasn't very familiar with MA at the time, so before presenting to the employees, I wanted to learn more about the company's complicated business. My speaker's bureau arranged for me to meet with the company's president, Peter Druss. I'm sure my first question made it blatantly obvious to him that I knew little about his field. But looking back, I'm thrilled I asked it, because his unforgettable answer gave me a big gift, the technique I'll share with you now. My first naive query was, "Mr. Druss, how do you judge whether a company would be a good one for your client to acquire?" "Well, it's a long process, Leo," he responded. "But my MO is always the same. First, I arrange with the company's top people to let me spy on their corporate offices. By that I mean just walk around unaccompanied by any of their higher executives. Then I watch the employees going about their business, sitting at their desks in front of their computers, speaking with each other or on the phone, and doing what they usually do. I just want to observe."
"Observe what?" I asked.
"Everything. Like seeing if employees are making eye contact with each other. Are they speaking energetically among themselves at regular volume? Or are they glancing around and lowering their voices like they're afraid someone might overhear? Does there seem to be any animosity between them? Does their body language express enthusiasm, or do they look lethargic? And here's an observation you might find interesting, Leal. I keep my eyes open to judge their energy level and how briskly they walk, particularly when they're in the hallways or going from place to place. I watch to see if they have what I call a sense of destination." Peter must have seen my confused expression because he continued, "I've noticed when workers are fully productive and absorbed in their tasks, they don't amble. When they leave their desk or station, they look like they know exactly where they're going. They don't dawdle, get distracted, or check their phones for personal messages. If they pass colleagues in the hall, they might greet each other or even stop for a few words, but as they continue, their speed and sense of direction tells me a lot. Are they concentrating on the task at hand and wanting to get it done? Or are they dreading it or bored?" As he spoke, my mind drifted to my own actions when I'm at home working on a book. I realized he was right. When I'm really into what I'm writing and get thirsty, I almost run to the kitchen for a glass of water and race back to my computer. Sometimes I'm so into it I even find myself postponing a trip to the bathroom. But then when writer's block sets in, as it inevitably does, I'll take the long route to the bathroom. I'll check to see if my phone is charged, and then spend a few minutes in front of the mirror combing my hair or primping myself for no one. I'll mosey back to my computer by way of the kitchen to check what's in the fridge, stop in the bedroom to see if I've left my purse there, open the front door to check the weather, and then slump back to my computer. Peter's insight into people's pace enthralled me so, while consulting at various companies in the following months, I watched the speed and energy with which everyone walked. At the more successful companies, I noticed the senior executives, both male and female, walked more directly at a faster pace. At one longtime client's firm, management had given me a heads up about which employees were being considered for promotions. After learning Peter Druss's method for judging a company, my observations confirmed it. I noticed the well-regarded workers walked more sprightly than the others. As they went from one place to the next, they seemed to have a destination in mind and appeared to be thinking about what they had to accomplish when they arrived. Other employees walked more leisurely, almost as though they had nowhere to go. Some looked like they were searching for an excuse not to return to their desks. Of course, this raises the question of whether certain employees were promoted because they looked determined as they walked, or were they truly dedicated and rushing to get things done? Who knows? But the faster-walking employees were usually the ones that management had singled out for promotions.
When you have a sprightly walk and definite destination in mind, everyone thinks you're more involved in your work. Visualize yourself going from place to place on the job. Did you ever consider that even the speed of your journey to the photocopy machine could send signals about your interest